changed on you, Brett? Did Vivian Howe borrow more than just the title of the song from her real-life experience? Brett smiles shyly.
The character in the book and I have a lot in common, but it's not me. I think what Vivi did in this novel was to take the emotions she felt while we were together and use them in the story. We were together our entire senior year of high school, and there were a lot of intense feelings. We were growing up in small-town middle America. It's the stuff rock and roll is made of. So many classic rock anthems use the tumultuous teenage years as their emotional touchstone.
On the screen behind Tanya and Brett is a photograph of a young Brett and a young Vivi on a bench at the mall sharing an Orange Julius. Those of us who knew Vivian Howe on Nantucket gasp. It's undeniably her, but she looks so different. Her hair is so long, her makeup so heavy. She looks like a young Joan Jett. In the novel, the character of Stott McElmore is discovered by a record executive, and Golden Girl becomes a big hit. Tanya pauses. What happened in your case?
My band, Escape from Ohio, had a record company interested in us. They flew us to LA. They really liked the song Golden Girl.
Brett smiles directly into the camera.
But that was before the age of iTunes and online music. If you wanted to make it big back then, you had to have an album in you.
He shrugs,
and we didn't.
On the screen now is a photograph of Vivian Howe in cut-off jeans eating an ice cream cone while sitting on the hood of a silver 1976 Buick Skylark. She looks for all the world like a character plucked from a Bruce Springsteen song. Who knew that this was how Vivian Howe grew up? She always seemed like the quintessential mermaid to us, raised by the ocean, sun on her face, salt in her hair, sand between her toes. There's a beat of silence. Tanya Price is the queen of the grand finale, so we all move a little closer to the screen and turn up the volume.
When was the last time you saw Vivian Howe? She asks.
August 1987. Brett says.
On the screen is a picture of Vivi and Brett standing side by side in their caps and gowns outside Parma High School. Brett holds two fingers up in a V over Vivi's shoulder. V for victory because he managed to graduate? V for Vivi? Or peace out? Was that a thing in the 80s?
And you weren't in touch all these years?
Brett shakes his head. I figured she had a happy life somewhere else. I didn't even know she was a writer.
He smiles ruefully.
I don't read much.
And then you heard she'd passed away.
Yes, through the sister of a friend, Brett says. I read her new book and I saw bits of myself in it, so I reached out to her family.
If you could tell Vivian Howe something now, Tanya says, what would it be?
Well, Tanya, you never forget your first love. It's a feeling like no other. So I guess I would tell Vivi, you always were and forever will be my golden girl.
Tanya holds out showcase hands. Brett Caspian, thank you for joining us. The broadcast cuts to a commercial. JP and Savannah stare at the television.
You swear she never told you about this guy?
JP asks.
No.
Savannah says.
But he's telling the truth. Could you believe those pictures? The eyeliner.
She'd abandoned the Wednesday Addams look by the time she got to Duke, thank goodness.
Don't you think it's weird that she never told either of us about Brett Caspian?
JP says.
Maybe he broke her heart and she didn't want to think about it after she left Parma, Savannah says.
Or maybe she broke his,
JP says. Amy claims she doesn't want to watch the segment, but it's Lorna's apartment, and there's no way Lorna is going to miss it. They don't have to be at the salon until 10. There's plenty of time to pour coffee, settle down on the sofa with Lorna's Weimaraner, Cupid, at their feet, and watch Great Morning USA. Amy is pretending like she needs extra time in the bathroom, but Lorna isn't buying it.
Just come out and watch, Pigeon. You know you want to.
Amy slinks around the corner, arms locked across her chest.
She has a big purple hickey on her neck that she got from Dennis, and she has done an inadequate job of covering it with foundation. I don't need another morning of my life to be about Vivian Howe, Amy says.
Is Dennis watching, do you think? Lorna asks.
No, Amy says. He's at work. As Lorna rubs Cupid between the ears, she predicts Dennis is sitting in his van, watching on his phone. When Brett Caspian sings, Lorna says,
Damn, but he's hot.
Why did Vivi get all the hot guys? Do you expect me to answer that? Lorna turns up the volume and sings along. You're the fire in my eyes. Cupid barks. Amy disappears. Back into the bathroom, Lorna supposes, to do something more about the hickey. Use concealer, she calls out.
Vivi. She's overcome. She's so overcome that Martha appears. Her scarf is twisted into a tight rope and secured around her neck in a way that looks painful.
It's not, Martha says. I'm fine.
Did you see Brett? Vivi asks. Did you hear what he said?
I heard what he didn't say.
Martha clears her throat.
Brett kept your secret. Nobody knows what happened between you two, and nobody knows how much of your book is true. So, you see, there was no need to use a nudge.
Martha is right. Vivi's secret is safe. Willa hasn't told anyone, not even Rip, and Vivi suspects she won't.
Thank you, Willie, Vivi thinks. I love you, and please forgive me.
Martha says, Have you checked your ranking on Amazon?
No. Vivi says, should I?
Martha shrugs. Vivi swoops down to the Manhattan offices of Mr. Hooper, where Floor and her assistant Jenny are jumping up and down in front of Floor's computer. Golden Girl is number one on Amazon. Number one! Floor clicks on bn.com. Golden Girl is at number one.
I just checked Twitter. Jenny says, people are clamoring for Brett Caspian's Golden Girl to be released as a single on iTunes. The YouTube video has 700,000 views so far.
This is the kind of publicity I've waited my entire career for, Flora says. She raises her eyes to the office ceiling.
We're going to do it, Vivi. We're going to get you to number one.
I'm not getting my hopes up, Vivi says. Martha starts humming. This is something new. Vivi listens closely. She's humming, You Can't Always Get What You Want by the Rolling Stones.
Are you trying to tell me something?
Not really, Martha says. I was just at choir practice and the song got stuck in my head.
The choir of angels sings the Stones? Vivi says.
Martha laughs. Oh, Vivian.
Oh, Vivian, what? She thinks.
If you try sometimes, you'll find you get what you need, Martha says.
Vivi isn't sure she needs anything other than for her children to be healthy and happy. But at 5 p.m. on Wednesday, August 11th, when the New York Times bestseller list is announced, D.K. Bolt's Satan's Weekend is at number 3, the Dorothea Benton Frank book is at number 2, and Golden Girl by Vivian Howe is at number 1.
I'm number 1,
Vivi shouts, and she dances around a bit with her hands in the air. She's certain this kind of behavior is frowned upon up here. Pride is a deadly sin and all that.
But she can't help herself. She is so excited. She has the number 1 novel in the country, and she did it without using any of her nudges.
She half expects Martha to appear, but Martha doesn't. Vivi doesn't need her. This moment is for Vivi to celebrate on her own.
Thank you, Brett, she thinks.
Willa, Carson, Leo, and Rip. Lucinda's birthday is August 17th, and every year, the Quinboroughs celebrate with a family dinner at the Field and Oar Club. Lucinda reserves the round table in the center of the dining room, so that everyone she knows can come bestow his or her warm wishes. This year, JP brings Savannah as his guest,
which would have been completely unthinkable in previous years, but with the event of Vivi's death, now feels just right. Willa and Rip are there. Leo has brought Marissa, and Lucinda invited Penny Rosen. Carson is alone. Normally, Carson would show up high or already drunk, but she seems straight to both Willa and Leo. It's only a matter of time, they suppose, until she orders a mind eraser and says something outrageous. Carson's theatrics bore them, but on the occasions of their grandmother's birthday dinners, they count on her for entertainment. Their grandmother's favorite server, Dixie, comes to take their drink orders. Willa is afraid that if she orders seltzer, someone will ask if she's pregnant again, so she orders a Chenin Blanc and squeezes Rip's hand to signal him not to say anything. Leo and Marissa order Cokes. Carson orders a ginger ale.
"Feeling okay, sweetie?" JP asks.
"Fine," Carson says. "Just taking it easy tonight."
This is highly, highly unusual, but nobody says anything. Penny Rosen starts the conversation by asking Marissa where she's going to college. Marissa says,
"Salve Regina, in Newport."
"Leo is heading to Boulder,"
Penny says, which is impressive, Carson and Willa think. Their own grandmother might not even remember this.
"So I suppose it'll be a teary farewell in a few weeks, with you two being so far apart."
"We're committed,"
Marissa says. She raises her voice so the whole table can hear her.
"Leo and I have set a date for our wedding, June 22nd, 2024.
"Wow," Carson says. "Have you booked a venue?" Leo knows his sister is baiting Marissa, and he also knows it will work. "Stop it, Carson."
"We haven't booked it, Marissa says, "but we've decided. The ceremony will be at St. Mary's, and the reception will be here."
"Here?" Lucinda says. "Are your parents members?"
"No," Marissa says. "My mother applied in 2016, but she's still on the wait list."
"It's a very exclusive club," Lucinda says, "especially for a single parent."
"But you belong, Grammy," Carson says, "and you're single."
"Yes, well, my father," Lucinda says.
"We're going to use Leo's membership," Marissa says, "if my mother doesn't get in."
JP clears his throat.
Lucinda says, "I don't think we need to be discussing an event so far in the future that may or may not ever take place."
Ouch, Willa thinks. She feels empathy for Marissa, maybe for the first time since she's known her. Mr. and Mrs. Bonham expressed this same cynicism when Willa and Rip said they wanted to get married. Penny says,
"College is about opening yourself up to new people and new ideas. It's best to embark on that voyage with a clean slate."
Marissa bows her head over the menu.
Carson says, "I hear the rabbit is delicious."
Willa tries not to gag. The Field and Oar does offer a rabbit dish on the menu, and all three of the Quinborough children have joked about it for years. Willa breathes in through her nose, out through her mouth. The drinks arrive, and JP raises his glass.
"Happy birthday, Mother," he says. "You look wonderful."
"Lucy never ages," Penny says. "It's irritating."
They all touch glasses over the center of the table. Willa brings her wine under her nose, and the smell further unsettles her stomach. She sets the glass down and picks up her water.
"Just so no one has any doubts, Leo and I are getting married, and we're going to be happy. Just like Willa and Rip," Marissa tells everyone.
Savannah says, "They're certainly setting a wonderful example."
"Can we please change the subject?" Leo says.
"What's wrong, bruh?" Carson says. "Getting cold feet already? It's only 2021.
Marissa narrows her eyes.
"Do you know why nobody likes you?" she says to Carson. "Because you try to be funny and, I don't know, clever? But you're just mean."
Carson laughs. "Am I the one nobody likes?" Marissa stands up, throwing her napkin on her plate. They all get a gander at just how short the dress she's wearing is. It's short enough to break every rule at the Field and Oar. Marissa storms off.
Leo sighs. We aren't getting married.
Thank God, Carson says. Thank God, Lucinda says. I hate to say it, but her mother is never getting into this club. Gordy Hastings finds her brash.
You're far too young to be talking about marriage, JP says. My advice is to wait as long as you can. There's no reason to marry your high school sweetheart. I'm sure Marissa is just the first of many girls for you.
Willa can't believe her father just said that. She kicks Rip under the table. I'm getting the chicken, she says to no one. Are you going to check on her? Savannah asks Leo. Or would you like me to do it?
She's fine, Leo says.
He reaches for a dinner roll.
She does this all the time.
She does this all the time, but this is the last time, Leo thinks. After dinner, he's going to drive Marissa home and end things for good. Marissa does come back, her nose pink and her eyes moist, and Dixie appears like someone heaven sent to take their order, so no one has to ask Marissa if she's okay. Willa needs air, so after she asks for the Statler chicken and Rip requests the sirloin, medium, he's been ordering this for dinner at the club since he was 5 years old and can't be persuaded to try anything new, but Willa views this as a sign of his innate loyalty. Willa says, we're walking to the water. Be right back.
I'm coming with you, Carson says. Stay put, JP directs, and Leo feels his airway constrict, because he wanted to go with Willa and Rip too. The atmosphere at the table is stifling. Willa and Rip stroll hand in hand over the clipped green lawn, past the flagpole and the cannon, shot off each night at sunset, to the water's edge. Willa has a vision of them a year from now at this same dinner, only they'll be parents, right? This pregnancy is going to thrive. It has to. I ordered wine because
I know why, Rip says. It was a good idea.
Drink some of it for me when we go back.
I will, Rip says.
They gaze across the harbor, listening to the piano music coming from inside the clubhouse, falling in love again, and admiring the soft blue and gold sky, the sailboats bobbing on the water. I miss her, Willa says.
I know.
It's fun to have Savannah here, Willa says. But do you think there's something going on between her and my dad?
Would that be so bad?
I just can't wrap my mind around it, Willa says. Savannah belonged to my mother.
I'll point out the obvious, Rip says. People don't belong to other people.
Tell that to Marissa, Willa says.
Marissa, Rip thinks.
She's having a tough night, and it's about to get tougher. Rip has some bad news about the claim her mother is trying to file with Marissa's Jeep. They turn around and walk back to the table. Rip waves to someone over Willa's head. When she turns, she sees Pamela and Zach on the tennis court. That's nice. Your sister and Zach are playing tennis together, Willa says, the wheels in her mind turning.
I'm sure she's eating him alive, Rip says. He has no serve.
Willa and Rip have just returned to their seats when the bartender appears at the table.
I just wanted to say congratulations, he says.
Why, thank you, Lucinda says. The bartender looks confused.
I mean, because I saw that Golden Girl went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
He seems to be speaking specifically to Carson.
You must be proud.
Carson is impressed. Marshall brushed up on his bestsellers and he had the guts to approach Lucinda's table unsolicited. We're so proud, Carson says. Thank you for acknowledging it.
I don't know what the young man is talking about, Lucinda says.
Oh, you do so, Lucy, Penny Rosen says. We went over this on Sunday. Vivi's new book went to number one.
Marshall hovers at Carson's place.
I went to the oyster catcher to see you last night. Must have been your night off.
Carson can't let him go any further.
She hasn't told anyone in her family that she's been fired, and now, over 2 weeks later, no one has asked, not even Leo, who lives with her. The only person who paid attention to Carson's comings and goings is dead.
I'll swing by to chat after we've finished, Carson says.
I'd love it. Until then, I'll be admiring you from afar.
He touches her shoulder, then turns and says, Happy birthday, Mrs. Quinborough.
Thank you, Lucinda says.
Then to Penny, That's more like it. A moment later, Pamela and Zach Bridgman stop by, sweaty in their tennis whites.
Happy birthday, Mrs. Quinborough, Pamela says.
We don't mean to interrupt your dinner,
Zach says. His expression, Carson can see, is strained, but his agony can be nothing compared to her own. The inside of her mouth becomes chalky. There's a bright, piercing pain in her chest. They were playing tennis together? This is hard evidence of their reconnecting, she supposes.
Who won?
Carson asks.
I killed him, Pamela says.
I have no serve, Zach says. I'm fat and out of shape. Me too, JP says.
Me three, Savannah says. Kudos to you, though, Zach, getting out on the court.
You look good to me,
Carson sings out. She winks at him, and everyone at the table chuckles. She can't believe her own audacity, and she's completely sober. But she isn't going to let him appear at her family dinner as though everything is just fine. He doesn't even look at her. He simply steps back with a raised hand, and Pamela takes the hint. They both head over to the bar and plop themselves in front of Marshall. Carson needs a drink, badly. But she won't let Zach break her. She's stronger than that. Their entrees arrive. They chat about the food and how it hasn't changed in 50 years. They discuss how busy it's been at the Cone and talk about Savannah's upcoming trip to Brazil.
You should go along,
Lucinda says, nudging JP's elbow.
I always wished the two of you would get together when you were younger, but it never happened.
That's right, JP says. I married Vivi.
And had us, Carson says, your beloved grandchildren. If Dad had married Savannah, we wouldn't be here, Grammy.
The silence that follows seems interminable. Leo gets up to use the restroom, then Carson and Willa disappear as well. Seeing his chance, Rip slides over next to Marissa.
I hate to talk business at dinner, he says in a low voice, but I need to give you a heads up that insurance isn't going to cover your Jeep at all. Not one penny.
Marissa shrugs.
I didn't think it would.
Does your mother know that? Because she's threatening to sue our agency.
She's just blowing smoke.
She doesn't have a leg to stand on. The coverage is spelled out. But it looks bad. For us, for your mom. And we pride ourselves on being an island business with excellent customer service. Having your mom going around complaining about how poorly she's being treated is unfair.
Marissa turns to Rip with an expression halfway between a smile and a snarl.
I just want to move on. My mom has plenty of money. She bought me a new Jeep, and the incident is ancient history. I apologized.
You apologized for intentionally trashing your perfectly good Jeep?
Yes. She knows I was upset because Leo broke up with me. She understands.
She understands. That's good for you, I guess. And the thing is, it's not a total loss in the end. She can still sell it. The engine wasn't as corroded as you'd expect for a car that sat in the bathtub overnight. The mechanic said it looked like the Jeep had been in the water for an hour, tops. But you drove it into the bathtub Friday night, right? And called the tow truck on Saturday?
Marissa swallows and casts her gaze down at her butter plate.
Right.
She's lying, Rip thinks.
But what else is new?
He's in claims. People lie to him every day. Willa and Carson use the secret bathroom on the second floor, across from the Commodore room, which is for private functions only. This was at Willa's suggestion.
I have something to tell you, she says, but you can't repeat it.
You're in luck, Carson says. I have no friends and barely any acquaintances. Normally, Carson would guess that Willa is pregnant, but she ordered wine at dinner, so that's not it.
Does it have something to do with Brett Caspian?
Carson asks. Because he said on TV that he's been in touch with Vivi's family, except it wasn't me, and we both know it wasn't Leo.
I told you I heard from this guy, Willa says.
You didn't.
I sent a group text to you and Leo telling you about the segment. You didn't respond.
That's right, Carson thinks. She saw the group text come in from Willa and deleted it without reading it. I've had a rough couple of weeks.
Why? Willa says. What happened?
Nothing.
Just tell me, Carson. I know I've been self-absorbed.
Yes, you have been, but that's okay.
What happened?
Willa reaches out and touches Carson's hair. She used a curling iron tonight, and her hair falls in long barrel curls. It looks very extra. Willa can't believe she made such an effort for Lucinda's birthday. And what is up with her drinking ginger ale?
You can tell me.
Carson wishes that were true. She's always wanted Willa to be the kind of big sister she could confide in and conspire with. But Willa is sanctimonious and judgmental. She thinks she's better than Carson morally. And, okay, maybe she is, but she doesn't have any compassion for people who are flawed.
You brought me up here to tell me something, Carson says.
It's nice being sober and having a clear head. I'm ready. Willa takes a breath.
Okay.
She glances at the door and lowers her voice to a whisper.
Pamela thinks Zach is having an affair.
Carson gasps, which is good because Willa interprets this as Carson is shocked because this is such juicy and unexpected gossip, rather than Carson is shocked because she's been caught, or nearly. Carson wonders if this has anything to do with the night last week when she and Zach had sex in the Bridgemans' living room. Carson won't lie. She was so deeply spooked that she hasn't had a drink since that night, and she hasn't contacted Zach at all.
I know, right? Willa says.
Her eyes shine with prurient excitement. Carson wants to be careful about how she proceeds.
He doesn't seem like the cheating type, does he?
No,
Willa says. But Pamela is so...
bitchy, Carson thinks, controlling, unpleasant. Merciless? Carson says. She clearly enjoyed beating the crap out of him at tennis. Willa rolls her eyes.
Does she think she knows who it is?
Carson asks lightly. Any leads?
Not yet, Willa says. She can't access his phone records because it's issued through ATC. But she texted me this morning to say she needs to talk to me ASAP, so there might be a new development.
Carson feels like she's riding a mechanical bull at the moment before she gets flung to the ground. Well, it's nice that she's made you her confidant. Willa laughs, then disappears into one of the stalls.
It is nice, she says.
Twisted, but nice. Willa, Carson, and Leo all return to the table just in time for cake. A yellow cake with chocolate frosting, yellow sugar roses, and Happy Birthday, Lucy, written in the middle.
Lucy, Willa thinks.
Penny Rosen must have been the one to talk to the pastry chef. Lucinda blows out the candles, then winks at JP and Savannah.
You'll never guess what I wished for.
Mother, please, JP says. Willa and Rip are the first to leave. Willa is tired, Gail's surprise. She likes to be in bed by 9, and it's an hour past that. Leo and Marissa leave next. Marissa is mopey and barely manages to say thank you and goodbye. JP and Savannah wait 10 minutes before they excuse themselves. Are they leaving together? Carson suspects their relationship is platonic. They probably sit around and talk about how much they miss Vivi. This leaves Carson, Lucinda, and Penny Rosen.
Carson says, I'm going to go flirt with the bartender.
Excellent idea, Lucinda says. Penny and I will join you.
No, Lucy, Penny says. I'm driving you home.
Happy birthday, Grammy, Carson says, and she kisses Lucinda's cheek.
Thank you, darling, Lucinda says. You were very well behaved tonight. I was surprised.
And I was disappointed, Penny Rosen says with a wink.
Carson takes a seat at the bar. Zach and Pamela are long gone, off for an evening of Zach's carbonara and Netflix. They'll chill, maybe have a little wine, maybe they'll make love. Carson tries not to care.
Pamela thinks Zach is having an affair.
Not any longer, Carson thinks. It's over. There's nothing to worry about, and Pamela can't access Zach's phone, so Carson is safe. She's not sure why her heart is beating so fast. Maybe it's because of Marshall.
What can I get you? Marshall asks.
Ginger ale, Carson says.
What the hell? Make it a Shirley Temple.
Marshall nods and cashes out the only other member at the bar, Dr. Flutie, who must be 100 years old. He used to play Santa Claus at the club Christmas party when Carson was a kid.
Shirley Temple seems a little strong for you, Marshall says.
Did something happen?
The club is a good place for Marshall to work, Carson decides, because he takes a genuine interest in people the way bartenders do in the movies. They're always portrayed as good listeners filled with sage advice. The only thing Carson ever asked people at the Oyster Catcher was if they wanted to cash out or start a tab. She's interested in making drinks, in providing quick, accurate service, and she's interested in cash on the barrel head. But she isn't interested in people. She has too many problems of her own to take on someone else's, even for 20 minutes. But Marshall's plate seems pretty empty, so he can heap on servings of his customers' anxiety and stress.
I got fired, Carson says.
She holds his eyes.
I had a douchebag customer, big money guy, who ordered kamikaze shots and asked that I do one with his group.
Marshall groans as he sets her Shirley Temple down in front of her. It's dark pink, nearly red. He had a heavy hand with the grenadine, but that's how Carson likes it, and he added 3 cherries. Bravo.
That happened 4 times, Carson says, shaking her head.
The situation with Brock Sheltingham is one that seems far worse now than it did in the moment.
What had she been thinking?
You did 4 shots with a customer?
Marshall says. He looks equal parts impressed and aghast.
Can you imagine if I did that here?
Then the guy asked me for a kiss, Carson says.
You slapped him, I hope.
I was too angry to slap him. I kissed him good, trying to make a point, which was lost among all the people cheering us on and filming it.
Oh, Carson.
And that's not even why I got fired, Carson says. I got fired because I insulted a barback who worked with me and she saw me doing coke in the ladies' room and told our boss.
Marshall is quiet. She has horrified him.
My boss, George, the owner, had been clear about us never doing drugs on the job. So I got fired.
I'm sorry, Marshall says.
Don't be, Carson says.
She stirs her Shirley Temple and watches the grenadine swirl through the ginger ale like watercolor paint.
I deserved it. George was way cooler than he had to be. He said he'll give me a glowing reference when I get my act cleaned up.
She looks up at Marshall, who is staring at her, bar towel draped over the shoulder of his pink Oxford shirt. He's wearing a Madras tie. He's absolutely darling.
Which is what I'm trying to do now.
You're doing pretty well, Marshall says. You made it through dinner with your family.
And I am not unproud of that, Carson says. But after my mom died, I went off the deep end. I was smoking too much, drinking too much, doing coke, taking pills.
She pauses.
I was abusing caffeine. I didn't want to feel anything. Also, I was in a bad relationship that just ended, so I thought, what if I give up everything that's hurting me and see if I feel better? She takes a sip of her Shirley Temple. I haven't given up drinking forever. I haven't given up weed forever. But I'm going to live clean until I feel strong enough to let those things back into my life.
Well, when you're ready to date again, I'd love to take you out, Marshall says.
What about your little Lily Pulitzer chickie? Carson says. The girl I saw you with at the box.
That was my buddy's girlfriend. I asked her to help me make you jealous.
What? Carson says. Are you serious?
I saw you dancing, and I asked Peyton to pretend to be my date in front of you.
Marshall grins.
Did it work? Were you jealous?
Carson laughs. She can't believe sweet, adorable, fresh as pine-scented air off a deep Oregon lake Marshall would dream up such a long-game caper to get her attention. Actually, she says, I was a little jealous. After Leo and Marissa leave the Field and Ore, Marissa wants to go to a party at Miacomet Beach. A bunch of summer kids from Connecticut they both know will be there. But Leo says he's not up for it.
Do you want me to drop you at the party? He asks.
I'm not going without you, Marissa says.
So I should take you home then?
What is wrong with you? Marissa says. You didn't stick up for me at all during dinner. Your entire family was making fun of our wedding plans, insinuating they won't even happen.
Marissa, he says.
He swallows. He should just tell her, the wedding won't happen. I'm not marrying you. I'm not in love with you. But he's too tired for drama tonight. He's too tired for drama anytime. He wishes Marissa would go to the party in her low-cut, extremely short dress and find someone else to sink her claws into. He wishes she and Peter Bridgman had hooked up at the bonfire the night before his mother died. This thought comes out of nowhere. Did he make it up? No, he thinks. He remembers seeing Marissa and Peter Bridgman sitting together in the dunes. This was when Leo sneaked away from the bonfire with half a bottle of vodka that he'd snatched from someone's cooler. Peter had his arm around Marissa. She was crying. This was before she drove her Jeep into the bathtub and hitchhiked home, a story Leo still doesn't quite believe. She would never, ever hitch a ride home with some rando. Did Peter Bridgman take her home then? He'd taken that picture. Leo can't ask Marissa to clarify the details. He doesn't want to know the details. All he wants is Marissa out of his car. I'll take you home, he says. The Chief. The Chief checks in with Lisa Hitt on her first day back from vacation. She says there were no good prints on the shoes, though there was some mustard. I need the clothes, Ed, she says. But her tone conveys what they both know is true. The clothes are gone. They've been tossed or destroyed. The Chief calls the Greek and asks him to subpoena Peter Bridgman's phone records. They won't be able to obtain the actual photograph, but they'll at least be able to see if Peter sent the picture to anyone other than Cruz and Leo on Friday night. And the Chief can talk to Jasmine Kelly. He finds out from Rocky Moore that the lifeguards meet every morning at 7:15 on Nobadir Beach for a mile-long beach run and calisthenics. They usually finish up around 8:15 and don't have to be in the chairs until 9.
You asking for any special reason? Rocky says.
I need to speak to Jasmine Kelly, the Chief says.
I hope she's not in any trouble, Rocky says. She's my top guard, top everything. She's smart, she's strong, she's a great kid. One of the greatest kids I've seen in 30 years of doing this job.
I just need her help, the Chief says. Bad, he thinks.
He's standing at the entrance to Nobadir Beach at 8:15 the next morning, sand filling up his shoes. Nobadir is wide and golden, a stretch of paradise, especially at this time of day. The sky is pink, and there are a few high, gauzy clouds. The waves form neat rolls as the group of lifeguards, 30 of them, all in red shorts and white t-shirts, finish their jumping jacks and collect their things. They stroll off the beach in groups of 3 or 4. How long has it been since Ed enjoyed a day at the beach? Feels like forever. He used to take Sundays off when Casey and Eric were small, and then again when he and Andrea became legal guardians for Finn and Chloe. But it's been 6 or 7 years since the twins needed or wanted a parent at the beach. Every once in a while, Andrea will pack a picnic, and she and Ed will drive on to 40th Pole to watch the sunset. Mostly, Ed works so that the rest of Nantucket can safely enjoy the beach. The chief sees Jasmine Kelly. She's talking to two boys, and when the chief hears her say, "Breakfast sandwiches at the Nickel," his stomach grumbles. He wants a bacon, double egg, and sharp cheddar sandwich with tomato and avocado on a griddled English muffin from the Nickel more than just about anything at that moment. That's another reason he has to solve this case. He needs to make things right for Joe's sake. All of the guards seem to notice the chief at the same time. He sees their backs straighten, their shoulders and jaws tense. Their eyes land on him in full uniform, and then they look away. Ed knows he makes kids uncomfortable. Am I in trouble? Sometimes Ed enjoys this, but not today. He smiles at the kids, waves, says good morning. He wants to assure them he's not here because of their unpaid parking tickets or a party at Gibbs Pond that they may or may not have attended. When Jasmine is close enough to speak to, he says, "Miss Kelly, may I have a minute?" Jasmine Kelly recoils. "Me?" The two boys remain at her side, sentries. The chief likes this. She has loyal friends. "It's nothing bad," he says. "I just have a few questions." She regards him frankly. Why her out of all the guards? She must be wondering. Why her and no one else? "Is something wrong?" "No," he says, holding up his palms. "I could just use some help. And someone gave me your name."
"Who was that?" she asks. She's not being rude, but she's certainly not eager to help.
The chief can tell, even from this brief exchange, that she's a straight shooter and will give him the truth.
"Joe DeSantis," he says.
"Big Joe,"
one of the boys says, then clamps his mouth shut.
"It'll take only a few minutes," the chief says. "I won't keep you."
Jasmine sighs.
"Wait for me, you guys, please,"
she says, and she trails the chief over to his car. Ed says,
"I'm investigating Vivian Howe's death."
"Are you, though?"
Jasmine asks.
"Whoa,"
Ed thinks. "She's tough." Well, she's Cruz's girlfriend, so he probably deserves her suspicion.
"Do you remember the night before Vivian Howe died?" he asks. "There was a bonfire at 40th Pole?"
"Yes," Jasmine says. "It was mostly seniors, my class, local kids."
"Do you know anything about a photo from that night being sent around by Peter Bridgman?"
Jasmine frowns, shakes her head.
"Peter? No. But I did see him hanging out with Marissa that night, after she and Leo broke up."
"Leo Quinborough?"
"Yes. Really, the only thing that happened at that party was that Leo broke up with Marissa. And later, Leo disappeared, and I saw Marissa sitting in the dunes with Peter. But I don't know anything about a photo, sorry."
The chief needs to think for a moment. Leo broke up with his girlfriend? Neither Cruz nor Leo mentioned this. And then the girlfriend was seen with the Bridgman kid? The Bridgman kid then sent Leo and Cruz a picture. Of him and Marissa, maybe? Was that what had them so upset? Or maybe it was a photo of only Marissa, a nude or whatever, which would have been upsetting coming from Peter Bridgman. Peter Bridgman is at camp for the summer in Maine. He must have left pretty soon after Vivian Howe's death. Peter Bridgman's mother is Pamela Bonham of the Bonham Insurance Agency. Did Peter Bridgman head over to the Howes early on Saturday to see Leo? Did he want to confront Leo or apologize? Did Peter Bridgman hit Vivian Howe? Cruz told the chief that he was coming from the Bridgman's house, that he went to see Peter, but Peter didn't answer the door. He also said he didn't see Peter's truck. Maybe Peter had just left. Maybe Cruz had missed him by a matter of minutes and knew he was heading over to the house, so he chased him, which would explain running the stop sign and speeding. The chief will find a way to talk to Peter Bridgman. But before he does that, he needs all the information he can get. "This Marissa," Ed says, pulling out his notepad. "What's her last name?"
"Lopresti," Jasmine says.
The chief stops, looks up. "Lopresti," he thinks. Willa. Pamela needs to talk to Willa, but she wants to do it when neither Zach nor Rip is around, which is tricky. Then a day comes when Zach is flying himself over to the vineyard to see his buddy Buddy, who heads air traffic control at MVY. They get together once a year. Zach is leaving early and will be gone all day.
"Can you come to my house at 9?
Pamela asks Willa.
"I have work."
"Can you come at noon?"
"I'm having lunch with Rip at the club," Willa says, though this isn't true. She has an OB appointment at the hospital.
"Cancel it."
"I can't,"
Willa says.
"The two of you are freakish in your devotion," Pamela says. "Do you hear me? Freakish."
Willa is proud of being freakish in her devotion. At least she's not monitoring her husband's every move trying to figure out who he's sleeping with.
"I know," Willa says with some smugness. "Can you come now?" Pamela asks. "Stop by on your way to work?"
"I was planning to ride my bike to work today," Willa says.
"Drive instead. You'll have extra time that way,"
Pamela says.
"There's something I have to show you."
Willa doesn't want to drive. She wants to ride her bike. And she's pretty sure she doesn't want to see whatever Pamela has to show her. She's already in too deep, so deep that she had to confide in Carson, which was risky. Telling Carson did lighten Willa's emotional load a little, and when Carson said she had no friends to tell, she wasn't lying. Carson is a lone wolf. Willa is sure she has friends at the Oyster Catcher and guys she meets at the box, but she isn't going to tell any of them about Pamela and Zach Bridgman's marital discord. Everyone is so self-absorbed that it's nearly impossible to find someone who can be fully invested in your problems. That has been Willa's experiences with the miscarriage. After the first one, people were sympathetic, but everyone wanted to hurry Willa along to, "You can just try again," rather than sit with her in the pain and the loss. Except Rip and Vivi.
"Willa?"
Pamela says.
"What?"
Willa says. She yanks herself up out of the rabbit hole.
Okay, yeah.
"You'll come right now?"
"Yes,"
Willa says. She will be invested in Pamela, she decides. She will go right now. Willa doesn't have time to waste, however. She walks into the Bridgman house on Gray Avenue and expects to see Pamela waiting, but the first floor is deserted.
"I'm here," Willa calls out, "and I need to be back in my car in 10 minutes.
There's no answer, and Willa is tempted to leave. This is so like her sister-in-law. Impose on another person's schedule, then make her wait. Willa knows that Pamela is this inconsiderate and worse with Zach.
"Pamela!"
Willa calls out. She hears footsteps upstairs. She thinks they're moving toward the stairs, but no, they're moving away.
"Okay, I'm going to work then. Call me later."
Willa manages to keep the annoyance out of her voice, but she's miffed. She thinks longingly of pedaling past the turtle pond, where Vivi used to take Willa and Carson and Leo when they were little kids. Vivi would patiently tie string around pieces of raw chicken and help them cast the lines across the surface of the water.
"Willa?" Pamela says. "Is that you?"
Yes.
Be right down.
Pamela draws out the word right, letting Willa know that she won't be right down. Willa hears a clock ticking in her head as she studies the family portraits on the server under the stairs. There are 4 years represented, photos taken by Lori Richards at Steps Beach. Pamela, Zach, Peter. They look happy is the thing. Pamela is actually smiling. Pamela and Zach are holding hands in a photo of just the two of them. Looking at these pictures makes Willa think of family dinners, weekly game nights, driving lessons in school parking lots, and Christmas mornings, not of a troubled kid at school and a husband who's sleeping around. Pamela finally descends the stairs. Her feet are bare, her hair is wet, she's wearing a turquoise linen shift with a statement necklace, oversized wooden beads on a string that looks like a bigger version of something Peter might have made at the children's house, and she's clutching something red in her hand. She holds it out to Willa.
I found this in the laundry.
This is a red lace thong. Willa has to fight to keep her morning tea down. She was right. She doesn't want to see this, some other woman's skanky underwear. At least they've been through the wash, Willa thinks.
I take it those aren't yours? Willa asks.
No. Does this look like something I'd wear?
Definitely not, Willa wants to say, but that might be insulting. And the truth is, no one can tell what kind of underwear a person wears, just like no one can tell what's lurking beneath a seemingly happy family portrait.
They're hanky-panky, Willa says without thinking. Despite her revulsion, she lifts the thong from Pamela's palm.
How can you tell? There's no tag. Do you wear underwear like this?
Her voice sounds accusatory and also incredulous.
No,
Willa says. She nearly adds, my sister does, but she stops herself. Pamela is right. The tag has been cut out, leaving a hole the size of a dime. A wave of nausea rolls over Willa. There's no avoiding it. She races for the powder room right there in the hall and vomits. When she emerges, Pamela opens her arms for a hug.
You poor thing. I made myself forget you're pregnant so I don't slip and tell someone.
It's fine, Willa says. The thong is lying on the server at the base of the most recent family portrait. What a juxtaposition.
Willa says, have you asked Zach about it?
Not yet. I'm going to wait. I'm collecting evidence, building a case.
And you're sure these aren't from a friend of Peter's?
Peter has been at camp all summer, Pamela says.
I only ask because this is the kind of underwear that young people wear.
Zach's lover is younger, Pamela says. She wears hooker panties.
Why was it in the laundry? Willa asks. Was the woman here, in the house?
No, Pamela shrieks. At least, I don't think so. I hope not. I found it stuffed deep in the pocket of Zach's khakis. I thought I would pull out a sock. You know how that happens in the wash sometimes. And it was this. She must have given it to him.
Ew,
Willa says. Pamela shakes her head.
You have no idea what it's like getting older, Willa. I hope Rip doesn't ever do this to you.
The notion is outrageous and mean-spirited. Willa is pregnant. Who says such a thing to a pregnant woman?
Anyway, I have to get ready for work, Pamela says.
Willa is being dismissed.
Thank you for coming over. I needed to share this with someone.
You're welcome, Willa says. This whole encounter has been very distasteful, and Willa is still smarting from the comment about Rip, as if. But that's not what bothers Willa the most. What bothers her the most is something she's too addled to admit even to herself. Pamela heads to the kitchen, calling out,
Coffee, here I come!
And Willa heads for the front door, scooping the thong up as she leaves. Amy. Amy loves Sundays with Dennis because he knows how to relax. JP was always up at the crack of dawn, which arrives very, very early in the summer, because he liked to be waiting outside the hub on Main Street when the guy arrived to deliver the New York Times. JP claimed this behavior had been ingrained in him from childhood in Manhattan. Sundays didn't begin for Lucinda or his grandparents until the Times was snapped open. But Amy suspects it has more to do with Vivi and the bestseller list. After he secured the paper, it was off to the Downey Flake to get a box of donuts and then home to make a second pot of coffee. Dennis, however, likes to sleep in. He has what Amy thinks of as a talent for sleep. He sleeps deep and hard, and nothing can stir him or wake him until morning. He makes a soft growling noise like a snuggly woodland creature, a welcome change from JP's snoring, which sounded like someone jackhammering asphalt. It was occasionally so bad that Amy would think, no wonder Vivi didn't fight harder to reconcile. When Dennis wakes up, he heads to the bathroom to relieve himself and brush his teeth. Then he returns to bed and makes love to Amy, skillfully. He's by far the best lover she's ever had, and falls back to sleep. Sundays are his only day off, same with Amy in the summer, and he doesn't feel the need to plan anything. Sunday is, as God intended, a day of rest. On the third Sunday in August, the summer is drawing to a close, and Amy, for one, is relieved. She and Dennis are lying in bed. They're at the part of the morning when they have just made love and Dennis has fallen back to sleep. Amy curls up against Dennis's wide, warm back and kisses the tattoo of an American flag on his right shoulder blade. She can see bright sunshine trying to insinuate itself into the room around the edges of the room-darkening shades. Amy always wishes for a rainy Sunday, the gloomier the better, but she hasn't been granted one all summer. The Sundays have been painfully beautiful. They'll have to go to the beach later, she supposes. Or maybe she'll suggest a late lunch at the galley. She has found Dennis to be lavish when it comes to spending money on fun, which is another thing she likes about him, in addition to the sex and the sleeping. They're really very compatible, she thinks. On this particular morning, Amy can't fall back to sleep. Probably because of the espresso martini she enjoyed last night at the Pearl. She isn't quite ready to get out of bed. She spends so much time on her feet at work that it's a luxury to lie down, so she resorts to looking at her phone. The only news she actually enjoys is entertainment news. When she clicks on the People magazine site, she sees the following headline, Golden Girl and Golden Girl claim number one spots. Keep scrolling, Amy tells herself, but she can't. She's lying in bed with Vivian Howe's ex-boyfriend after a bad breakup with Vivian Howe's ex-husband. Her adult life here on Nantucket has been shaped by Vivi, and even though Amy has vowed to change this, she clicks the link. Golden Girl, the novel, is at number one. Amy saw the headline splashed across the front of the Nantucket Standard this past Thursday. Everyone on Nantucket was proud of Vivi because she had finally nabbed the top spot. The article at People.com says that Brett Caspian, Vivi's high school beau, recorded the song Golden Girl with Apple Music shortly after his appearance on Great Morning USA. It shot straight up the iTunes chart to land at number one. It has 12 million downloads this week. Holy crow, Amy says. She taps Dennis on the shoulder. Dude, guess what? He murmurs unintelligibly. He's asleep. She should let him be. Remember that guy I told you about on TV who wrote that song for Vivi in high school? The song Golden Girl? Lorna had been convinced that Dennis watched the segment and was only feigning indifference. But Amy knows he's given up on all Vivi-related things cold turkey in a way she can't seem to do. She doesn't want to bother him, but this is cool. This is rock star stuff. Dennis utters another soft mumble. The song Golden Girl went to number one in iTunes, Amy says. She clicks on the iTunes chart and there it is. I think this guy works at a Holiday Inn or something, and now he's famous. The song has a bajillion downloads this week. Dennis rolls over, grabs Amy's phone, and sets it on the nightstand. He kisses her collarbone and nestles his face between her breasts.
"Do you know who my golden girl is?"
he asks.
"Do you?"
"Me?" she says. She runs her fingers deep in his hair the way he likes her to.
"Yes, you," he says. "You and only you."
Vivi swoops down to check the screen of Amy's phone. Quickly, quickly, the last place she wants to linger is Dennis's bedroom. Sure enough, Golden Girl by Brett Caspian is the number one song in the country, 34 years after it was written. "Martha!" Vivi calls out. "Martha!" But she doesn't appear. She must be listening to the choir singing Ruby Tuesday. When Vivi checks on Brett, she finds him at a party in the lobby of the Holiday Inn in Knoxville. It's a farewell party. Vivi gathers from eavesdropping that Brett is moving to Nashville. He's going to write and record an album. Brett Caspian has a hit song at the age of 51. Vivi thinks of the boy sitting two rows ahead and one seat to the left of her in his detention, turning around and winking at her, and how she felt he'd picked her, like an apple from a tree. She thinks about the back seat of the Buick Skylark, him kissing her as Steve Perry wailed on the car stereo, "Stone in Love." She's even more emotional now than she was when her book hit the top of the list. Golden Girl might have topped the charts long ago if only Vivi hadn't lied about being pregnant. If only she had been blessed with a stronger sense of self. If only her father hadn't killed himself. Wasn't Vivi worth staying alive for? If only she'd had the maturity to understand that she and Brett had different dreams and that was okay. Vivi didn't lie about being pregnant because she was evil. She lied because she was young and she was still mourning her father. Vivi decides to cut her younger self some slack. Martha appears. A red and gold scarf is tied around her midsection as a belt.
"Can I ask you a favor?" Vivi says.
Martha sighs.
"Would you like me to use my powers of the road not taken? Do you want me to tell you what would have happened if you hadn't told Brett you were pregnant? If he hadn't rushed back to Parma to be with you?"
"Yes, please," Vivi says, "if it isn't too much trouble."
"Define too much trouble," Martha says. She chuckles. "Just kidding, but I have to concentrate."
Martha settles in one of the peach silk souffle chairs, props her feet on the leather pouf ottoman, and closes her eyes. Brett is in Los Angeles. He does a demo of Golden Girl.
"I know that already," Vivi says.
Martha opens one eye. "Would you like me to do this or not?"
"Sorry."
Martha resumes her concentrating. Brett writes a second song called Miss My Baby, and he records a cover of Carolina on My Mind, and the record company grudgingly accepts Parmatown Blues. But that isn't enough. Wayne gets arrested for buying cocaine on Sunset Boulevard. Roy's mother is diagnosed with brain cancer. The band breaks up. Brett keeps the rights to the two songs he wrote and finds a different record exec, one somewhat less reputable than John Zubow, who agrees to release Golden Girl as a single with Miss My Baby as a B-side. It has modest success. Golden Girl hits number 37 on the top 40 in February of 1988 for 1 week.
"That's it?" Vivi says. "Number 37 for 1 week?"
Kid Leo plays it on WMMS as a favor to his brother-in-law, who works with Brett's father. Brett's a local kid. Cleveland is a rock and roll town. Kid Leo genuinely likes the song, but even playing it as often as he does, the song doesn't gain much national traction, so it never gets any higher than 37.
"Then what happens?" Vivi asks.
"Brett moves to Las Vegas," Martha says. "He plays on the strip, sings Golden Girl and some cover tunes. He develops a gambling problem."
"Seriously?" Vivi says.
He marries a blackjack dealer named Sonia. They have two kids, they get divorced. There's an ugly custody battle. Sonia takes the kids to New Jersey, Atlantic City. She's still a blackjack dealer.
Martha opens her eyes.
And Brett stays in Vegas. If you hadn't told the lie about being pregnant, he would be living there still.
Instead, he lives in Knoxville.
Yes, Martha says. And Golden Girl is the number one song on iTunes.
So maybe my lying about being pregnant was a good thing for Brett, Vivi says.
He had to wait 3 decades, but he made it to number one instead of stalling out at 37.
Maybe this was the way things were supposed to work out.
Martha pushes herself up from the chair. I think you're finally starting to get it, Vivian, she says. Willa. She keeps the red lace thong stuffed deep in her purse. It's the same brand of underwear that Carson wears and, more damning, it has that hole in the back where the tag is supposed to be. Carson's skin is sensitive. She can't handle even a thin bit of tag remaining along the seam, and Carson is careless. So to avoid irritation to her precious backside, she cuts a hole in a $22 lace thong. It's the kind of intimate detail you know only about your sister. It's Carson's thong. Willa is sure of it. But what was it doing in Zach's pants pocket? Are Zach and Carson having an affair? The thought is outrageous, nearly laughable. Or is it? When Willa told Carson that Pamela thought Zach was having an affair, how had Carson reacted? What had she said?
He doesn't seem like the cheating type, does he?
Willa thinks about this. Was Carson trying to cast doubt on Pamela's suspicions? To downplay them, dismiss them? Next, Carson said,
does she think she knows who it is?
Not notably, does she know who it is? Is this distinction telling? Then Willa remembers that Rip told Willa a few weeks earlier that Pamela saw Carson's Jeep parked at the abandoned horse barn across the street from the Bridgman's house. Pamela told Rip she thought Carson was there to meet her drug dealer. Willa had been annoyed by Pamela's low opinion of Carson, even though she too thought it was likely Carson was there to meet her drug dealer. Carson had not been there to meet her drug dealer, Willa thinks now. The red lace thong with the hole where the tag should be is Carson's, and the thong was in Zach's pants pocket, and Carson was lurking across the street from the Bridgman's house because she and Zach are having an affair. Willa shoots Carson a text. Are you working tonight? Carson responds, no. Willa says, Rip is golfing after work with Mr. B. Wanna come to Smith's Point for dinner? I'll get Millie's takeout. Carson says, sure. Please order me the Caesar with grilled shrimp and chips with queso. Willa says, great. See you at 7. Carson shows up on time, which is very unlike her, and she seems serene, but in a natural way and not a stoned out of her mind way. She has brought Willa a bouquet of flowers from Bartlett's farm, purple and white cosmos, Willa's favorite, and a thermos of iced tea. Mom still has all this mint growing in her herb garden, Carson says, so I tried making her tea. I'll have some with dinner, Willa says. She has already been to Millie's to pick up the food. She doesn't want any distractions. Would you like wine? No, thanks, Carson says. I'll have tea. Who are you and what have you done with my sister? Willa thinks. A drunk or high or angry or condescending Carson is the only kind of Carson Willa knows how to deal with. Carson acting human, even gracious, isn't anything Willa was expecting. Come out to the back deck, Willa says. It's only 4 steps from the front door of Wee Bit to the back door. It cracks me up how small this place is, Carson says. But really, what else do you need?
I miss my dishwasher, Willa says, and my Peloton, and reliable internet.
Yeah, but look at this view. They step out to the deck. The eelgrass on top of the dunes is swaying in the breeze, and they can both hear the pound and the rush of the surf. Willa has become used to the sights and sounds out here, is nearly immune to it, though there are still times when she walks down the deck steps wrapped in a towel on her way to the outdoor shower that she stops to marvel at the ocean or the gulls soaring overhead. Tonight, the sky is awash in golden light, and Willa nearly says something about heaven and her mother, like, "Do you think she can see us? Do you think she's watching us?" But she doesn't want to sound ridiculous. "I'm happy you have the night off. The sunset is going to be epic." Willa pauses. "Although I suppose you see the sunset every night at work." Carson takes a seat on one of the benches at the picnic table. "Well," she says, "I got fired." Willa inhales.
"You did? What happened? When was this?"
"End of July," Carson says. "I was inappropriate at work."
"Inappropriate meaning?"
"I did shots with a customer. I French kissed a customer. I did cocaine in the bathroom."
"Carson," Willa says, "tell me you're kidding. Please tell me you're kidding."
Carson bows her head. When she looks up, her eyes are like two flashing emeralds. Willa remembers when they were little girls, their father would come into their room in the mornings and say to Carson, "Wake up and show us the jewels." He never said this to Willa. Her eyes are brown. "Not lying," Carson says. Her voice is taut, and Willa relaxes. There's going to be a fight, which Willa is prepared for.
"I suppose you're going to judge me now," Carson says, "because you're perfect. By which I mean you're sheltered and unadventurous, and although you're 3 years older than me, I've lived a far more exciting life."
Willa wants to ask more questions about Carson getting fired. Getting fired? How mortifying. What is she doing to the family name? But instead, she cuts to the chase. She pulls the thong out of the pocket of her floor-length prairie skirt. She's surprised Carson hasn't yet made a crack about Laura Ingalls Wilder, and places it between them on the picnic table.
"That yours?" Willa asks.
She eyes the thong with distaste. It's a scarlet scrap of lace with a hole in it. Tawdry. Carson picks it up, pokes a finger through the hole.
"What the hell, Will? Did you come home and raid the laundry? What's going on?" "What's going on," Willa says, "is that Pamela found that in Zach's pants pocket."
Understanding sweeps across Carson's face like passing headlights through a dark house. "It's not mine."
"It is so. You just admitted it."
"I have underwear like that," Carson says, "but if they were in Zach's pants pocket, they obviously aren't mine." She brings her eyes up to challenge Willa. "Are they?"
"They are," Willa says.
She turns to face the dunes, the ocean. The breeze lifts her hair, stirs the loose material of her skirt.